Welcome to the Wild Heart Meditation Center podcast, where we take Buddhist practices and principles and apply them to our everyday lives. If you're enjoying this podcast, please subscribe or follow, and maybe take time to rate us wherever you are listening. And if you feel moved to leave a donation to support our nonprofit meditation center in Nashville, Tennessee, you can leave a donation by visiting our website, wildheartmeditationcenter.org. Peace and love. I hope you enjoy. Welcome to the Wild Heart Meditation Center podcast. My name is Mikey Livid. I am the guiding teacher at Wild Heart Meditation Center in Nashville, Tennessee. And I am so stoked for today. We have a special guest. Sharon Salzberg is joining us, and she will be teaching an live online event with us at Wild Heart Meditation Center Saturday, August 9th, and it will be a benefit for our rapid growth at Wild Heart. So wherever you're listening to this, please join us since it's online. You can get the link and sign up and register at wildheartmeditationcenter.org. And so let's just get to it. What a special occasion we have going on today. We have world-renowned meditation teacher, meditation pioneer, New York Times best-selling author, the co-founder of Insight Meditation Society. Just her work has affected me in so many ways, and I know so many of you listeners, and my heart is full to see Sharon Salzberg on my screen. Hi, hello, welcome to the crew, welcome to Wild Heart Meditation Center Sangha. Great to see you.
Well, thank you so much.
Yeah, I'm interested in diving in a little bit. Something about me that I have such a respect for lineage, and at Wild Heart, we're affected by a few different lineages, and you being one of them. So many great teachers that came from the past, like Ajahn Chah from Thailand, Mahasi Saidal from Burma, Anagarika Munindra, Deepa Ma, and I know some of these names you have known personally, but within those names, your name is in there. And I am so grateful because so many of us came into meditation because it became available. So while we can get an app or listen to a podcast or go to a local meditation center, I'm so curious, how did you get into meditation?
Well, that's an interesting question, because especially when you mentioned something like an app, you know, which of course didn't exist way back when. Well, I went to India when I was 18 years old. I was a college student. I had taken an Asian philosophy course in college, and it just lit me on fire with the desire to learn how to meditate. So this is like 1970, and I was going to college in Buffalo, New York. I looked around Buffalo. I just didn't see it anywhere. And so I created this independent study program, asked to go to India to study meditation for a year, and they said yes. So off I went. And I think, you know, something we used to talk about a lot was how strong an intention each of us needed to have, people like Joseph Goldstein, Jack Kornfield, me, in order to learn a practice, because it just wasn't around that much. It was, of course, around, but it was hard to find and hard to put into practice. You find more of like an academic study of a language like Sanskrit or something. And as the teachings through these years have become more and more available, people didn't need as wild and intense a motivation in order to access it. So it's just been an interesting process kind of watching that. But that's basically how I went. I, like many people, I'd had a childhood full of suffering, and for some reason I had this insane kind of conviction that if I could learn how to meditate, I would be a lot happier. And so I grew up in New York City, I went to college in Buffalo, went to India. I'd never even been to California before. I said, I'm going to go to India and study meditation, and there I was, you know.
Yeah. And, you know, I think about you, I think about like Joseph Goldstein and all this, when I'm like, damn, I don't know if I want to drive 20 minutes to the meditation center. And to think about, you know, the people that have passed this down to me, what they had to do just to meditate. And it's quite a motivation. And maybe this is presumptuous to me, but we start with the first noble truth of suffering. And that could be a hell of a motivator to get me to drive those 20 minutes, not only seeking happiness, but responding.
Yeah, yeah.
And if it's okay for me to ask, that had to be some presence of dukkha, some presence of unsatisfactoriness to get you to go to India. What was the fuel for that journey?
It was suffering, and it was also, you know, when I did that Asian philosophy class as a sophomore, I did it because it was a philosophy requirement, and I just happened to choose that one. And it completely changed my life. For one thing, here was the Buddha saying right out loud, you know, unafraid, unashamed, there's suffering in life. And for me, you know, I'd had a really chaotic and difficult childhood, but I also had a family system, as many people do, where this was never, ever spoken about. Mm-hmm. And so I didn't know what to do with all of those feelings inside of me, and I felt so different. Mm-hmm. You know, my family didn't look like other people's families, and there was, of course, the whole media spick and span, you know, like image and it was hearing that statement from the Buddha, which, of course, many people find incredibly depressing, that for me it was liberating. It was like, oh, you belong. This is a part of life. It's not just you. You're not weird. You don't have to feel so left out. You know, you're a part of things. And so that was the first step. And then the second step was, in the context of that class, I heard that there were methods, there were techniques called meditation. And if you actually did them, if you put them into practice, you could be a lot happier. And that was it. You know, it was like, it was completely insane that I went to India. I mean, I was so timid, and, you know, I'd never been anywhere, and I had to get a passport and, you know, like figure it all out. And I did. I just went because of that thought, this could make me happier.
Yeah. And just when you said, yeah, you belong, just hit me so hard, like, just that, just right in an emotional place. While, yeah, it may seem depressing to some people, we start with that truth of suffering.
Yeah, yeah.
For me, 100%. It's like that I thought I was weird because I was having a hard time, or I was living life incorrectly.
Yeah, right,
because
exactly.
I was suffering. And then it was like the Buddha saying, yo, we're all experiencing this. And just even you saying, yeah, well, you belong. Ugh, that's so beautiful. Yeah. So as you, on your quest, you know, where were your first teachers? Like, where, you know, do you still remember who were some of your first teachers?
Yeah, I'm not that old. I mean,
Well, you know, sometimes we come across people and it's just like, oh, I don't even know that person that taught me mindfulness of breathing. I don't even know who they were.
No.
Do you remember who they were?
Of course. That's very funny, though. I mean, maybe it's that way nowadays because it's just kind of there. It could be the app, you know, it could be a mechanical voice or something, or digital voice. But in those days, it was not that way, you know. It was a very personal, direct transmission. So I went to India. I knew I was interested in a Buddhist approach from the class. I started out in Dharamsala. This is after getting there, which took a few months, you know, because it was overland. I started out in Dharamsala because I heard the Dalai Lama lived there, and I heard he was a Buddhist. I was just on fire with this thought of, I have to learn the techniques. I have to learn how to meditate. So there was a meditation class, but both the approach of that particular school of Buddhism was a lot of study before you practiced, and also it was just one of those situations where it just didn't work. Like, I'd go to the class, and they'd say, oh, the translator's out of town for 2 weeks. Come back in 2 weeks, and I'd come back, you know, so it just wasn't working. And then I overheard a conversation in a Tibetan restaurant saying that there was going to be an international yoga, Hatha Yoga conference in New Delhi. So I thought, oh, I'll go there. That's where I'll find a teacher. So I went back to New Delhi, and it was a really dismal kind of affair because the low point was like when these yogis and swamis were pushing and shoving against each other to be the first to grab the microphone to speak. And I thought, man, this isn't going to work, you know? And then Dan Goleman, who at the time was a graduate student in psychology, years and years later wrote this book, Emotional Intelligence, you know, and so became quite well known. But in those days, he was this graduate student studying meditation. For some reason, he was delivering a paper at that conference. He was giving a talk. And I went to the talk, and at the end of the talk, he said he was on his way to this town called Bodh Gaya, which is actually the town that's grown up around the descendant of the tree they say the Buddha was sitting under when he became enlightened. And he was going to do this intensive 10-day meditation retreat taught by this teacher, S.N. Goenka, who had just left Burma. And it was an approach that was very practical. It was very direct. It was really a how-to approach. And I listened to Dan, and I thought, that's it. And it was it. So in effect, I followed him to Bodh Gaya and did my first intensive 10-day retreat. It began January 7th, 1971.
Wow.
And that was the beginning. That's actually where I met Joseph Goldstein. He was there as a student on the retreat. Ram Dass was there as a student on the retreat. You know, many people who really became lifelong friends. And so I did many courses with Goenka, you know, many 10-day courses. It was really a method of like a few days of mindfulness of the breath at the nostrils, so anapana. And then what these days we call a body scan. He called it sweeping. You move your attention through your body, picking up sensations. So that was basically it. And he did a little loving kindness meditation right at the end as a way of saying goodbye. So that was my introduction. And I did many courses with him. I studied with other people in Bodh Gaya, including Menindraji and Deepa Ma. And then that was really my foundation.
I'm going to restrain myself from going off into a complete tangent about asking about stories about Deepa Ma or Menindra, but...
No, I'll tell you a Deepa Ma story because it figures
it's important.
Okay,
please do so, yeah.
So I stayed in India a little longer than my designated year from school. Went back to America to sort of do what I needed to do. Just a few things to end up with 2 years of independent study credit rather than one, which I did. And then I went back to India to keep practicing and studying. So 1974 comes around, and I was getting ready to leave India for what I was convinced, absolutely convinced, was a very brief return to the United States before I, like, went back to India for the entire rest of my life, which is what I was sure I was going to do. So I went to see Deepa Ma, who was living in Calcutta, to get her blessing for my very, very short trip back to the United States. And Joseph, actually, whom I had met at my first retreat, had already come back maybe 6 months before. And when I saw Deepa Ma and explained that I was going back to the States, she said, when you go back, you'll be teaching. You'll be teaching with Joseph. And I said, no, I won't. And she said, yes, you will. I said, no, I won't. I'm coming right back. And anyway, I mean, the thought of me being qualified in any way to teach was ridiculous. You know, I thought, I can't do that. And she kept saying, yes, you will. And I said, no, I won't. And then she said two things that were really important. She said, you really understand suffering. That's why you should teach. Mm-hmm. And then she said, you can do anything you want to do. It's your thinking you can't do it that's going to stop you. And, of course, in terms of the suffering, I did take note. She didn't say, you're so enlightened, therefore you should teach. You know, I had never really thought of the difficulties and the chaos I had gone through as offering me something that would help other people. You know, mm-hmm. And then the second part, of course, you know, I didn't believe. So I walked down. She lived up on what we would call like a tenement room, sort of up four flights of stairs. And I walked down those stairs thinking, no, I won't. That's absurd. I could never teach. And then came back and, you know, and the story unfolded so that, of course, you know, I woke up one morning and I thought, oh, she's right. She was right. Look at that.
And so for the listeners who may not know who Deepa Ma is, I love that she's almost like the original of one of us as a layperson, really taking on these practices to the intensity that she did until she became fully enlightened, arahat, and there's a smile there. I don't know
if she would say she was fully enlightened. They don't exactly tend to do that, you know. Like,
well, yeah, I don't want to, you know, be tacky here. and she's a very advanced, or was a very advanced,
yeah, she was
practitioner,
a very advanced practitioner
that maybe had some interesting insights beyond the average mind that knew things about you, saw things in you that you yourself could not see.
Exactly.
Yeah. Well, so when you're talking about going on these retreats with Goenka, you said the magic word, loving kindness. Mm-hmm. And as you will be teaching loving kindness with us on August 9th, the power of loving kindness. And maybe you had some insight into your own audience a little bit here, bringing loving kindness to the forefront of your teachings is something that I'm endlessly grateful for, because loving kindness is my main practice. And I do think there is a need within our modern world to practice this lovely practice of loving kindness. And so where did you get this kind of know-how that to bring loving kindness to the forefront of the practice rather than something you do at the end of the retreat that you're going away with? But really, how did you know to do that?
Well, I had that first exposure right at the end of the Goenka retreat, and I thought, what was that one? You know, but mm-hmm. I didn't have any clear instruction or structure to pursue it. And then I tried to read about it on my own, and, you know, remember, this is also a long time ago, no internet,
mm-hmm.
you know, very few books in English. And it was only in 1985 that I got to go to Burma and study with this Burmese monk, Saida Upandita. I'd met him the year before when we brought him to Barry, to the Insight Meditation Society. Mm-hmm. And I asked him at the time in Barry if he would teach me loving kindness meditation. And he kind of laughed and said, come to Burma. So the next year I went to Burma and I did an intensive 3-month period of practice of loving kindness with him. So that's really gave me the methodology and the structure and the kind of how to do it. And it was a hugely important practice for me. They say the Buddha taught loving kindness as the antidote to fear. And I would say, like, of all the hindrances and whatever, you know, I had more fear than other things, you know. And it was an amazing practice for me. So when I came back, I'd already been teaching since 1974. I started teaching loving kindness as a method, and it was unusual, you know, in the circles that I was in. I do think it's at the core, as a quality, not necessarily as a practice, because it's its own style of practice. As a quality, it is at the core of mindfulness practice for two reasons. One is when we're practicing concentration on anything, let's say just feeling the breath, you know, and resting your attention on the sensations of the in and out breath, it's usually not that long before your mind wanders, you know.
Mm-hmm.
So how do we speak to ourselves when we realize we're distracted? Like, very often we just jump on this train of judgment. I'm so bad. I'm so terrible. I'm so awful. No one else is thinking, you know, whatever. And because of that, we extend the period of the distraction sometimes a lot. And we're so exhausted that it's hard to just begin again and begin again. So you've got to have a kind of loving kindness and compassion for yourself in order to concentrate successfully. And then when you look at mindfulness, which would mandate that we look at all the different thoughts and feelings and sensations without judgment, without condemnation, that's not that easy, you know? We have a lot of shame. We have a lot of self-blame. And to have a kind of balanced awareness, like, oh, this is what's happening right now, implies also there's a kind of compassion for ourselves. It's a kind of loving kindness in the air. So I think it's really core, and not everyone needs to develop it as a distinct method. I did, you know. Mm-hmm. I mean, not that my practice was useless before. It was wonderful before, but the loving kindness helped a lot. And so when I started teaching it, there was a lot of sort of, you know, that's, it's like a feel-good practice. You're not helping people face their suffering head-on. And it took me a long time to realize it was kind of a gendered thing. Like people were saying, oh, that's like a girly practice, you know. It's sentimental, which of course it's not. But you have to have the experience of it very deeply in order to realize that. So I just kept on teaching it, you know. And I've been incredibly gratified. I'm not sure in a totally wholesome way to see the tides turning. You know, now there's a lot of research on loving kindness meditation. There's a lot of schools that use it in one way or another. You know, it's different than that immediate reaction.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And so, okay, you learned it predominantly in this 3-month retreat.
Yeah.
What was the technique? You know, you get there, 3-month retreat, you sit down in meditation. How are they teaching it in Burma for 3 months?
Yeah, so that is not the only way it's taught, I should say right away, but it is the way I was taught it, you know, and so therefore the way I teach. They tend to use phrases, the silent repetition of certain phrases, rather than, say, resting our attention on the feeling of the breath, the in and out breath. We rest our attention on the silent repetition of these phrases. And these phrases are like expressions of generosity or gift giving, like may you be happy, may you be peaceful. And the skill set is very similar to other practices in that we rest our attention on this chosen object. Our minds wander all over the place. We learn to let go and come back. So the phrases are a distinction of loving kindness practice and the offering, because we offer those phrases to various beings, starting with ourselves. And then over time, I don't mean in any one session because it would be kind of crowded, but over time, we offer loving kindness also to someone who's helped us, someone we feel grateful for, someone who kind of lights us up when we think of them. Could be an adult, could be a child, could be a pet. We offer loving kindness to a friend. And sometimes we divide it, like first a friend doing well right now and then a friend not doing so well right now. We offer loving kindness to someone known as a neutral person, someone we don't especially like or dislike, just kind of there in our lives in some way. We offer loving kindness to someone we find difficult. And then we offer loving kindness to all beings everywhere, to all of life. So like I said, it's not all crammed into one session, but this is what we do over time. It's gift giving, it's offering through the use of the phrases. So another way of saying it is that we learn to pay attention differently, you know. So like with ourselves, instead of going through the list of our faults one more time, you know, we sit there and make that offering. May I be safe. May I be happy. May I be peaceful. Something like that. And those are, in general, you can make up your own phrases. They need to be very broad. Common phrases people use these days, starting with ourselves, are things like, may I be safe, be happy, be healthy, live with ease. Live with ease means in the things of day-to-day life, like livelihood, family, may not be such a struggle. May I live with ease.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And, you know, the common rub-ups. It's like, I don't feel at ease. I don't feel safe. Like, what do I do? Like, I hate myself. Like, what do I do in these scenarios?
You keep practicing. I mean, it's not to rub out that feeling of hatred. It really isn't. But there are other channels available to us. We just don't usually go there. And one of the difficulties I have found, not only for myself, but for many others, in loving kindness practice is that the fruit of the practice, the changes we go through, usually don't manifest in that, let's say, 20 minutes a day when we're formally practicing. They manifest in our lives, which is where it actually counts. But you need to be patient, you know, because what we do is we scrutinize the 20-minute period and say, I'm still, you know, a loser. But we will be different. It's like one of my favorite stories about loving kindness is somebody took me to lunch once in New York City, and he said, this is a kind of confessional lunch. So I said, okay, what are you confessing? And he said, I've been doing loving kindness practice now as my main practice for about 3 years, whether I'm on retreat or I'm just sitting at home. And he said, I have to say my sittings 3 years in are not that different from how they were in the beginning, but I'm like a completely different person. He said, I'm different with myself. I'm different with my family. I'm different ethically. I'm different with my community. And then he looked at me and he said, is that enough? And I said, yeah, I kind of think that's enough, you know. But I know it's so frustrating sometimes because we just look at that 20-minute period and say, I'm still getting sleepy. I don't feel great waves of love. And one of my things, which is a little bit also unpopular, is I really believe it doesn't matter what you feel when you do the practice. It's the intentionality. It's the return to those phrases. That's what counts. That's what makes the difference.
Yeah, what a permission I'm hearing. Yeah, we don't have to feel a certain way is what you're saying, huh?
Yeah.
And so we do categories, and you're saying like over time.
Yeah.
It's not going to just happen in 20 minutes. We do mm-hmm. ourselves, mm-hmm. a friend, a neutral person. And then you said this very, lit me up, you know, dealing with the difficult people in the world. And you know, it's such a common thing where it's like, well, what about, not that we need to get into politics, but there's politics in our minds a lot yeah. lately. So I'm supposed to wish those politicians loving kindness? I'm supposed to think nice things about them? Why would I want to do that?
Well, I don't know that we're thinking nice things about them particularly, but the loving kindness or the compassion doesn't take away wisdom or insight. It's not like you're dancing around saying, oh, it doesn't really matter. Maybe it does matter, you know, what their views are, what their actions are. But there are a few things. One is I often come back to that teaching about the Buddha that he taught loving kindness is the antidote to fear. And so sometimes I look at a certain dynamic. It doesn't have to be a politician, although it could be, you know, could be mm-hmm. someone in your personal life. And I ask myself, is this a dynamic? Is this a relationship where I would suffer from having less fear? Mm-hmm. And it's never a yes. You know, mm-hmm. less fear always seems like a good idea.
Yeah.
So it's an experiment to see if that's how it actually works. It's also true that we can have a compassionate attitude towards someone and take very fierce action to try to stop them. It doesn't mean that our action is to be timid and pleasing, you know, but we're not coming from a place of hatred, which is all to our benefit, you know, because the hatred will wear us out. So it's things like that. And also, there's an underlying principle to all of loving kindness practice, which is that it's meant to be done in the easiest way possible. And that's why, ironically, they begin the rotation, the sequence with oneself, because mm-hmm. we're supposed to be the easiest person of all to have loving kindness for. And so maybe in the time of the Buddha, mm-hmm. in that culture that was true, doesn't seem to be universally true now, you know? And so I just say, change the sequence. Start with your puppy, you know, if that's your benefactor, and then put yourself in later. You have to include yourself somewhere, but it doesn't mm-hmm. have to be first. And then with a difficult person, they suggest you don't start with the most unbelievably difficult person imaginable, either in your personal life or on the world stage. Like, start with someone where there's a little bit of conflict or unease, dis-ease, mm-hmm. and more slowly make your way over to more difficult. People don't like that, but that's also mm-hmm. the instruction. You know, there's something very heroic about us. We want to, like, burst through to the hardest thing of all. And then I'd also say there's a lot of creativity and flexibility in the practice. Sometimes you want to generally be using the same phrases so you don't get so distracted and lose concentration, but you can't always use the same phrases. You know, in all kinds of different circumstances, you might want to change them. So it might be that the difficult person is one of those circumstances. Like I've had people say to me, in terms of a very past, painful, and abusive experience relationship, the only phrase they could use in directing loving kindness toward this person was, may you be free of hatred. And that worked. The measure of the practice is working, of whether the practice is working, is that you can actually do it. Not mm-hmm. some great burst of presumed love, but can I actually do it? So we need some creativity sometimes and change the phrase. Or I've also had people in the text, they say with a difficult person, maybe imagine this person is an infant, so helpless the way we all were to the actions of others. Imagine them dying, not with glee, but, you know, after all this, we all have to let go of everything and see what happens. And so we extrapolate from that. Is there a situation in which you can imagine this difficult person where you can then send metta? Like somebody told me once, I imagine my difficult person on an island. No bridge, no aqueduct, no boat. I gave him a coconut tree so they could eat. I don't want to starve them to death, but there is no way they could get close to me. Then I could do the practice. So you can also have a little bit of fun with that.
Yeah, I appreciate the creative engagement with loving kindness. A coconut tree on an island, and what a permission, huh?
Yeah.
You know, one thing I do come up, I hear a lot though, it doesn't feel safe to mm-hmm. practice loving kindness. You know, I do have my own opinions on this, but I'm curious about yours. Like, what do we do if we just don't feel safe to practice loving kindness or approach the world with loving kindness?
Well, I mean, it is an experiment. It's up to you. You know, you don't have to feel coerced or, you know, you're mm-hmm. being forced to do it. You can also do it in the ways that seem easiest. Loving kindness for yourself might feel unfamiliar or bizarre, but I don't know that it's going to feel unsafe. Loving kindness for those who've helped us, many of whom we forget about, sort of, you know, we don't acknowledge them necessarily day to day. That's going to be okay. Loving kindness for the neutral person is also interesting because you don't, usually we say, see if you can choose someone who plays some role in your life, you know, grocery store clerk, someone you tend to see now and then, but don't necessarily have a big feeling for or against. Maybe you feel a little too vulnerable, you know, you care too much, but then you have to, that's why it's an experiment, you know, to see mm-hmm. that it doesn't leave you kind of overcome. Mm-hmm. You know, there's also some balance in there because you also have loving kindness for yourself.
Yeah, and I appreciate that answer, you being just a powerful voice of loving kindness, still saying, it's an experiment, kind of like the Buddha's words, go and see for yourself.
Yeah.
And it's such a permission to be like, yeah, go see.
I think it's also, you know, something I learned and I think I try to emphasize in teaching, and we kind of made reference to it before, loving kindness or compassion it's an internal state of freedom. It's a motivational force. It doesn't define the right action, you know, and that's partly what people are afraid of. They say, if I were to practice loving kindness, doesn't that mean I have to lend them more money? Mm-hmm. Doesn't that mean I have to let them move back in? Doesn't that mean I have to say yes? And I've heard every variation of that question, including some really painful ones. Does that mean I have to visit them in jail? Even though, you know, it's just like, mm-hmm. and some of the, you know, really terrible things that can happen in life. No, it doesn't mean any of that. It means that whatever we choose to do out of discernment, hopefully out of wisdom, can be motivated not by hatred, not by fear, not by kind of reflexive reaction. And that's the truth of things, you know, so we're not consigned to being this sort of simpering, you know, appeasing people pleaser.
Their right intention.
Yeah.
That's beautiful. Quite a leap of faith, but gives us a framework to approach life. If we act with loving kindness in our heart, that will be the right action rather than living according to black and white rules. I love that. I love it. And so, well, thank you for all of that. And also, I want to kind of know you right now. Like, there is this projection of Sharon Salzberg, and I'm sure what I think about you and assume your life looks like is probably not exactly the same as your life, but please, if it feels right for you, could you welcome us into your life a little bit? Like, what is your life these days? Are you just float around on fluffy white clouds, just shooting loving kindness in all directions to all beings everywhere, and that's what you do all day long? Or you know, what's
definitely
your life these days?
That's my life. Yeah. You
know. Okay, good.
Yeah, I mean, it's just my life, so it's you know, I don't know what the projection is, but you know, I came back from India in 1974 and started teaching because of Deepa Ma. We co-founded the Insight Meditation Society in 1976. So next year is our 50th anniversary.
Awesome.
I'm in New York City right now. I live in Barrie, but I have an apartment in New York, you know, which I come to now and then. And my first book was Loving Kindness. It was called Loving Kindness. It came out in 1995. And
I got it sitting right there.
You do.
It's such a great book. I love it.
Thank you. And I've written many books since. I have a children's book coming out in December, which is really cool, kind of on loving kindness. It's called Kind Carl. It's about Carl the crocodile who learns to be kinder. I haven't been on an airplane since, I think, March 4th, 2020. So most of my teaching, almost all my teaching is on Zoom or some medium like that. And I feel very comfortable in that medium. I feel very connected to people. Hoping to write some more. I have a literary agent. She asked me what I wanted to write about. So I thought about it really deeply. And I thought, I want to write about suffering and the end of suffering. And so I sent her a couple of paragraphs. I think it was a little too depressing for her. So I need to flush that out some because, you know, as we were talking about before, it's not a depressing topic for me. Mm-hmm. I don't know what else to say.
How about meditation? Like, what does your meditation look like these days?
In the beginning of 2020, when I moved back to Barrie, basically thinking, not knowing, you know, how long that would be for before I started traveling again. And it turned out to be a lot longer than I imagined. I thought before then, you know, when I was on the road a lot and things like that, I do sit every day. My sitting, my formal sitting, had pretty much become a mindfulness, kind of open awareness practice. But I did a lot of loving kindness walking down the streets of New York, every airplane ride, every taxi ride, something like that. And then that was gone because I wasn't doing any of that. So at that point, I brought back kind of formal loving kindness more into my daily sitting. And that's sort of where it is now. You know, either I am doing loving kindness, which I do a lot, or I'm doing a kind of open awareness practice. And I sit, I try to sit in the morning. It's at least 20 minutes a day, you know, hopefully more like 40. And then I also try to pay attention to those little moments. You know, it's like I have a friend, a colleague who told me when she's on like a Zoom call and she sees all those faces in little boxes, she'll silently be thinking, may you be happy, may you be happy. May you be happy. May you be happy. So I do try to bring it into my life in those ways.
The loving kindness practice has been a lifesaver for me on airplanes. I get airsick and all of that, and you know, some of these airlines are they're bonkers, right? And it's how much I could just like watch people walk into the airplane. And you think, may you be filled with loving kindness. May you be at ease. May you be at peace. And it's just like, we're all in this together. Like, yeah. It's such a great practice for day to day walking around mindfulness, right? It's, I love it. So the other thing is like, you know, do you watch TV? Do you, you know, are you involved in pop culture? Because that, you know, that's a big part of our culture at Wild Heart is like, yeah, what about seeing the Dharma in everyday things? Do you watch television?
I don't really watch much television. I, years ago got completely immersed in The West Wing.
Okay.
And then I thought, when that was over, I thought, I can't make another commitment like that, you know. But I do. I watched, I'm more streaming than TV. I watched The Pit.
What is it?
The Pit. Oh, you don't know The Pit?
No.
It was a series, they're just shooting the second season of this emergency room in Pittsburgh called The Pit.
Oh.
And so it's really good. I have a lot of friends in healthcare. And they say it was not 100%, but very close to that, accurate of what it's like. And that's sort of drawn me in again to, you know, to medical drama. I don't know why. It's so traumatic. But
it's so you're into dramas is what I'm catching. Yeah. That's awesome. Yeah. That's awesome.
And I'm more into theater than movies, you know, being in New York. Although some movies, you know, I've seen a few movies, but very few lately. Mm-hmm. But some more theater. My sort of life-changing experience in the theater was seeing Hamilton 10 years ago.
Oh, yeah.
And I've written awesome. About that because the story is I was working on a book, Real Love, and I was very late with it and very discouraged, thinking, I don't have anything left to say. This is my 10th book. Nobody cares what I have to say. Mm. Just like phone it in. Just turn something in. And just then a friend came through New York and said, would you like to see something in the theater? And I just kind of randomly said Hamilton because I'd heard about it, but I didn't really know about it. And so we got us tickets to Hamilton, which were very hard to get. And Lin-Manuel Miranda, who wrote it, was still playing Alexander Hamilton. So I sat there in the theater staring at him thinking, you wrote this. Hmm. This all came out of your brain. You can never just like compromise and turn something in. You have to put everything you've got into everything you write. And my friend still teases me. And he said, and then I said to you, do you want to go out to dinner? And you said, I have to go home and write. And it's been that way ever since. So Hamilton is really my number one.
The insight of watching Hamilton, huh?
That's so good.
Well, cool. So as we're on the back end of our time together, anything else you would like for us to know, or anything else you'd like to add?
I'm so pleased that your center is in existence and growing, and that, you know, we'll have some fun together, you know, that evening and do some loving kindness. I'm very glad to hear it's such a big part of your practice.
Huge. Endlessly grateful because, you know, there's a hint that if you didn't exist, I wouldn't have this practice. And so thank you so much for passing this practice down. And shout out to Tanya. Tanya, you know, old school Wild Heart member.
Yeah.
Like, I love Tanya so much, and that we have a mutual friend in Tanya. So,
yeah, no,
our sanghas are connected. Yeah.
Yeah, but maybe you can all teach me something about pop culture. So that'd be good.
Tell you what TV shows to watch.
Yeah, no, definitely.
Well, thank you so much for your time, and thank you for supporting Wild Heart Meditation Center. And once again, the shout out, Saturday, August 9th, 6 p.m. Central, The Power of Loving Kindness with Sharon Salzberg. I am so looking forward to it. Thank you for taking time out of your day to have this discussion, and to be continued.
It's great. Yeah, thank you.